Okay, I'm sure more people are going to be coming on, but I already have 9 o'clock, so let us begin. This is the last class of this semester. We will start. We will not finish with the Ketav Sofer, Rav Avraham Shmuel Sofer. If we didn't do the Chasam Sofer, I would have postponed him to sometime in the future. But since we did the Chasam Sofer, it's worthwhile. I think it's probably just have two classes on him, but it's important to speak about the Sofer dynasty. Here is the map. Everyone can take a look at the map. There you have Bratislava, right next to Vienna, as I mentioned. If you move up a little bit where the arrow's going, now I'm into Brno or Brun. If you know the name Mari Bruna, he's one of the late Rishonim. He's mentioned a lot by the Rama and the Shulchan Aruch. He comes from Brno. Now we're in Moravia. And then if we move up where the arrow is, we're in Bohemia. The Czech Republic is divided between Bohemia in the north, Moravia in the south, and of course when it was Czechoslovakia, then the Czech Republic and Slovakia were one country. And over here is Frankfurt, where the Chasam Sofer comes from. So now I think the geography should be clear to everyone. I'll pull up the map later, I think, today. If not today, next time we meet, because it'll be relevant. Okay, let us begin. Today, as I said, well, let me put a picture of him on the screen here. A picture from his youth. There's other pictures, but that's one I found easily. Avraham Shmuel, Abraham Samuel, Binyamin Sofer, born in 1815, when the Chasam Sofer was 52 years old. The name Avraham was not original to his name, but was added to his name when he was 6 years old and quite ill. And but everyone knows him, just like we know the Chasam Sofer by his title, we know the Ketav Sofer by the title of his book. After the Ketav Sofer, I'll mention briefly the son, the Shevet Sofer, and then there's another son, Rabbi Kiva Sofer, the Dot Sofer. We'll get to that next semester. The Chasam Sofer always intended for his son to take over. In fact, this Sofer, the name is Schreiber, but Schreiber in Hebrew is Sofer. This became a dynasty unlike any other in Europe in that you had four generations as rabbis. When Rabbi Akiva Eger, the father-in-law of the Chasam Sofer, dies in 1837, he dies just 2 years before the Chasam Sofer, asks his son, Rav Avraham, to deliver the Hesped. And now that's a big deal, the Hesped. And he does this, we're told in the biography, the traditional biography, to build up his son in the eyes of the people. Now, it turned out in the end that the Rabbi Akiva Eger had requested no hespedim, so Rav Avraham never delivered the hesped. Furthermore, the Ketav Sofer said to his father, I'm not going to deliver the hesped. He refused to deliver it. He wrote it, but he said he was not worthy of delivering such a hesped at the young age of 22. Now, shortly before the Chasam Sofer dies, his son, the Ketav Sofer, begins to deliver shiurim at the yeshiva and before Talmidei Chachamim every Shabbos. The Chasam Sofer also asked him to daven the Ila in the great synagogue of Pressburg. All this was to build him up, to get the community ready for him to take over. A few days before the Chasam Sofer's death, the community leaders actually come to the Chasam Sofer and request that he appoint the Ketav Sofer as his assistant to teach in the yeshiva and to decide questions of halacha. And they also request that after the Chasam Sofer's passing, the Ketav Sofer takes over. So the Chasam Sofer's plan to bring his son in as his successor worked. Now, a big moment happened at the funeral. I mentioned the venerable Av Beis Din, Rav Daniel Prostitz. Let me show you his Rav Daniel Prostitz. Here is his grave, Prostitz. Right next to, in English it's sometimes written as Prosnitz, but it's, I think because that's how the city's name is written. But in Hebrew it's Daniel Prosnitz. He was older than the Chasam Sofer. He was born before the Chasam Sofer, 3 years older, and he outlived the Chasam Sofer, but he's important because he was Av Beis Din. The Chasam Sofer was the Rosh Beis Din, I guess, the Supreme Head, and then you had, the Chasam Sofer didn't sit on little court cases. That was Rav Daniel's position. But Rav Daniel was very influential, and he brought the Chasam Sofer to Pressburg. And you see a sign of how influential he was, in that he's buried right next to the Chasam Sofer. That's something that everyone would want to be buried there, and he's buried right next to him. At the funeral, Rav Daniel, this elder Rav, this influential Rav, much older than the Kassav Sofer, because he's, as I said, he's older than the Chasam Sofer, so he's some 54 or 55 years older than the Kassav Sofer. He stands up and declares his loyalty to the 24-year-old Avram Shmuel Binyamin Sofer. And that pretty much brought everyone along, and he was crowned next rabbi at Pressburg. This was very common in Eastern Europe. Just like in the monarchy, the king is dead, long live the king. So too with rabbis, it was very common at the funeral to declare, now once the body is placed in the ground, you declare who is the new Rav, and if it's the son, you declare the son right there. Sometimes it's not the son, it's someone else who's in the city. It can always go this way, often that they had to then start looking for a Rav, and it could take a while to bring one in. But in many times, especially when the son would take over, he was crowned at the funeral. The Kassav Sofer, upon taking over, took over the yeshiva, and the yeshiva did not decline over the Kassav Sofer. The yeshiva had 300 students, sometimes as many as 400 students. The only, I guess you could say, break in the walls were that after the Chasam Sofer's death, the reformers, I call them reformers, although really the technical term later on is neolog, and when we say reformers, they have nothing in common with the reformers that we know of in America, and they really have nothing in common with the reformers in Germany. We're talking about people who at the most would want to have an organ in the shul. The men and women would sit separate, the organ would be played by a non-Jew. We're not talking about extreme reform. That'll come later in Hungary, although it was never successful in Hungary, but it was successful in Germany. But after the Chasam Sofer's death, the reformers tried to build a shul in Pressburg, and the Orthodox turned to the government and were successful in having it shut down. We've seen this already, that the Orthodox, when they had the power, they used the arm of government to shut down the reformers. During the Kassav Sofer's lifetime, another 30 years after he becomes rabbi, that's when you had the Great Congress that led to the split in Hungarian Jewry. I'll speak about that probably today or next class, how Hungarian Jewry was split between the reformers, the neolog, and the Orthodox. And then there's actually a third element that we'll speak about called the status quo communities, who the Orthodox treated them just like the reformers. The Orthodox persecuted them. They declared that status quo shochtim and rabbis were not valid, just like reformers. This despite the fact that status quo communities were completely, at least most of the time, completely shomer Torah and mitzvos, and some of the rabbanim in the status quo communities were gedolei Yisrael, students of the Chasam Sofer. And yet, as we will see, they were declared to be rebels, and you even had some status quo communities that were Hasidic, but we'll get to that. The Chasam Sofer was very strong when it came to separating from the reformers. We mentioned that already. The Kassav Sofer, we'll see soon, and I'll mention it now as well, he was more moderate. We will see that he wanted to prevent the split if it could be prevented. And his followers did not leave the Congress when the extreme Orthodox left it. We'll get back to this. But once the split becomes formal, then the Kassav Sofer goes along with it, that there has to be a complete ausstritt, a complete split, just like in Germany, where the Orthodox and the Reform have nothing to do with each other. And the situation in Hungary until the Holocaust was that every community was either associated with Orthodox or with Reform. And if the Reform, let's say, were in charge of the community, the Orthodox could have a separatist community, or you could have the status quo community, which I'll explain what that is soon. But there was complete religious division in Hungary, just like in Germany, but much more in Hungary, because in Germany you only had separate there were only four separatist communities, or five separatist communities in all of Germany. In Hungary, every single city in Hungary, every single small town in Hungary, and we're talking about hundreds, were divided. Either they were allied with the Orthodox, allied with the Reform, and sometimes you'd have the Reform, the small Orthodox group would create a separate community. There was a Hungarian law that comes in mid-19th century that candidates for rabbinical positions, that is to be recognized by the government, and there were certain things you needed to do as a rabbi. You had to fill out certain forms, all sorts of things like that. They had to finish 4 years of high school. So what are you going to do when you have a situation like that that requires rabbis to have a secular education? Well, in the Hasidic parts of Hungary, they wanted nothing to do with that, and they ignored it. The fact that it was the law of the land, they ignored it, and they would never send their children for any secular education at all. However, the problem was that there was an exemption for theological students, given not just for students studying in the Catholic seminaries, but also given for those studying to be rabbis. However, the only way you could get the theological exemption were if you to be, it was if you were to be officially registered in a yeshiva, in a school of higher Jewish learning, to be a rabbinical, training for a rabbinical position, and that you could only be if you had finished 4 years of high school. So officially, everyone who was wanted to get an army exemption and train for the rabbinate had to have had 4 years of high school. So again, when in the parts of Hungary where they were Hasidim, they didn't listen to this, and if someone's number came up for the draft, this person would disappear. He would disappear into Hungary, into Poland or somewhere else. They would run, just like they did in Russia. However, this was not the approach of the Kassav Sofer. And by the way, this was not an extreme requirement for most people in Hungary, that is the non-Hasidic. 4 years of high school. Nevertheless, most of the rabbis were opposed to it. As you can imagine, they were opposed to secular studies. They sent delegations to the government leaders to protest, but the law remained. And many rabbis never came to terms with this law, which they called it Gezerat Arba'a Klassen. That is the Gezera of the four classes, that anyone who wants to be a rabbi has to take the four classes. The Pressburg Yeshiva, however, decided to work with the government, work with the law. First of all, the Pressburg Yeshiva, as the most distinguished and important yeshiva in Hungary, they couldn't have a situation where they'd be ignoring the law. And this was the most important yeshiva. In addition, it was a more modern place, and you had parents who were more modern who sent their kids there, and therefore the Kassav Sofer decided that the Pressburg Yeshiva would go along with this law, would accept it, and therefore the Pressburg Yeshiva declared that no one who has finished 4 years, unless only one who has finished 4 years of high school, would be accepted as a full student in the yeshiva. It's amazing when you think of it. The Pressburg Yeshiva makes this declaration. This did not mean that you actually needed to have attended 4 years of high school to study for the rabbinate at Pressburg Yeshiva. You had to have a certificate attested that you had accomplished 4 years. You could do that externally by hiring tutors, and there was all sorts of institutes that you could study. You could do it in maybe 2 years, and then you had to take examinations. When the law was passed, there were students who were already in the Pressburg Yeshiva, and they had no formal secular studies. So they studied under tutors and took the tests and passed them, even though they never actually went to secular schools. The Pressburg Yeshiva did not bring secular studies into the yeshiva. They didn't want the students. I mean, they could have set up evening classes in secular studies, as the Volozhin Yeshiva did for a time. Rather, they told the students, which was the way it was in America for a long time after World War II, they told the students on their own time, or in the afternoons, the evenings, that they have to study and get a document attesting to having the four classes. If you were in the yeshiva already, or you could even come to the yeshiva, and you would not be an officially registered student in the yeshiva without the four classes. But you would still be in the yeshiva, so in the real world, it didn't make much of a difference. If you had no interest in training for the rabbinate, you just wanted to sit and learn in the yeshiva, you could do that, and you could sit and go to shiurim. However, if you wanted to get smicha from the yeshiva, then you had to officially be have completed the four classes, so either you came and had already completed them, or while you were studying informally at the yeshiva, you were taking classes. I guess it's sort of like Ner Yisrael is today, that it permits college, and this causes the other Haredi yeshivas to look down on it. It was the same thing in the Pressburg yeshiva. The Pressburg yeshiva, although it's regarded as the greatest yeshiva, was looked down upon by the Hasidim. Yekusiel Greenwald, in his memoir, which is translated into English, describes how he's on the train, and there are Hasidic young people on the train, and he asks them where he's going, and he says the Pressburg yeshiva, and he has to suffer all sorts of abuse because of that, because they thought the Pressburg yeshiva was a place of kfira, and that you go there and you study secular subjects. This extreme opposition, it needs to be said, to secular studies in Hungary, among many of the Orthodox, did lead many of the traditionalists into the arms of the neologues. Some of them felt who remained Orthodox, left Hungary. They went to study in Berlin with Israel Hildesheimer. First they went to study in Eisenstadt, in Hildesheimer's yeshiva. But we know that the rabbinical seminary of the neologues was full of people from traditional backgrounds who couldn't tolerate the extreme Orthodox opposition to secular studies. Because even the Pressburg yeshiva, which allowed the four classes, high school classes, that is, it didn't permit study at the university. I mean, you could go, I guess, afterwards, but it frowned upon that. So if you believed in secular studies, and by the end of the 19th century, early the 20th century, many Hungarian parents did want their children to have advanced secular education, the extremism in Hungary was too much. When the Kassav Sofer agreed to share the rabbinate, as it were, with Israel Hildesheimer in the mid-19th century, then he agreed to allow secular studies into the Pressburg Yeshiva, just like an Eisenstadt. Now, this incident, which I'm going to describe right now, was not known in the Kassav Sofer's life. It was only revealed by Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer after the Kassav Sofer died, I guess because he didn't want it to create controversy. He didn't want him to be attacked by the extremists. Although even before this incident, which I will talk about now, everyone in Hungary knew that Kassav Sofer was more moderate than others. Rabbi Chaim Sofer, who's the Machane Chaim, becomes the Rav in Budapest, he writes how the Kassav Sofer actually wanted a kosher seminary, as opposed to a reform seminary, which is exactly what Israel Hildesheimer wanted. This Rav Chaim Sofer, incidentally, would later send his son to study in Pressburg, under the Kassav Sofer's son, the Shevet Sofer. But when he thought that the Shevet Sofer was going to insist on the four classes, he withdrew his son from the yeshiva. And although a grandson of this Rav Chaim Sofer, the Machane Chaim, who was one of the most extreme of all the Hungarian rabbanim, a grandson of his, also named Rav Chaim Sofer, did study in the Pressburg yeshiva. We have many examples of this, where the grandchildren of these extremist rabbis would end up becoming more moderate, more liberal. Another good example is Rabbi Shlomo Gottfried, the author of the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, who was a real extremist, I don't know if you get this from reading the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, but he's one of the rabbis who signed the proclamation I'll talk about soon. His grandson goes to the Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin and becomes a liberal Orthodox rabbi in Prague. So there are many examples of this. Let me talk about this incident of the Kassav Sofer inviting in Azriel Hildesheimer. It actually happens, there was a man named Aviezer Schick. He was a student of the Chassam Sofer, now living in Pressburg, who was more liberal than many others. In fact, he became, I guess you could say, a maskil. And he was one of the community leaders, and he, together with others, convinced the Kassav Sofer that they needed to have a different type of rabbi. The Kassav Sofer was fine to decide questions of halacha, but the younger generation was German-speaking. The younger generation wanted secular studies. You needed to have a rabbi who could preach to the community, who could relate to the more moderate element of the community, the more modern element. As I said, there was a lot of enlightenment in Pressburg, but religious enlightenment. That is, people who were religious, but also were more enlightened. And the Kassav Sofer agreed with this. So Schick contacted Azriel Hildesheimer to find out who would be a good candidate to come in and serve as an assistant rabbi, as it were, to the Kassav Sofer. And through these discussions, the idea came to Schick and others that Azriel Hildesheimer would himself be the best person for this. And they went to the Kassav Sofer with it, and they got his agreement to offer Rabbi Azriel Hildesheimer the position of second rabbi in Pressburg. Now understand what this means. Azriel Hildesheimer in Eisenstadt is being subjected to all sorts of attacks by the extremist Orthodox for his yeshiva there, which had secular studies and everything else. And here the Kassav Sofer agrees to invite Rabbi Azriel Hildesheimer to come to Pressburg to be the second rabbi. So we see already where the Kassav Sofer stands. But it's even more, because Rabbi Azriel Hildesheimer gave as one of his conditions to be second rabbi, that with the exception of the Kassav Sofer giving his shiur in yeshiva, which he would continue to give, and obviously the Kassav Sofer would paskin shilas and things like that, Rabbi Azriel Hildesheimer would have complete control of the yeshiva and complete control of all the other educational institutions in the city. And he would also, of course, give a shiur at the yeshiva. So here you have the Kassav Sofer agreeing to allow the Pressburg yeshiva to be taken over. That's his yeshiva, that's his father's yeshiva, to be taken over by Azriel Hildesheimer, to be turned into a modern rabbinical institution. And not only that, all the other educational institutions. Another condition, and the Kassav Sofer agreed with the second condition as well, was that the second rabbi would be completely equal to the Kassav Sofer, and both rabbis' approval would be needed for in any communal matter. Now, can anyone think of another example where a communal rav agrees to bring in an outsider and say that we will now be completely equal? We have one great example about Rosh Yeshivas, that Rav Amital, I mean, this is famous, he invites Rav Lichtenstein to become co-Rosh Yeshiva and joint Rosh Yeshivas, that they will be completely equal. But where else do you have examples of this, where a rabbi who is in charge of a city, for the betterment, for the good of the city, agrees to give up his authority, to share his authority equally? It would be, you know, it's one thing to bring in a second rabbi, and even that's problematic often, but to give up your authority, the Kassav Sofer agrees, because he feels that this is necessary, that there will be two rabbis, a dual rabbinate. I don't know of any other examples where in Jewish history you have a dual rabbinate, where you actually have two equal rabbis. We have plenty of examples where you have two well-known rabbis. For example, the Tvinsk, let's say. You have the Rugachever and Rav Meir Simcha. We'll deal with Rav Meir Simcha next semester. But these are rabbis of two separate communities, the Hasidic community and the non-Hasidic community. what the Kassab Sofer was doing was bringing in a second rabbi to share his domain. Now, the rabbis tell us you can't have two kings and one crown. But here, the Kassab Sofer was willing to try. He was very friendly with Israel Hildesheimer, and he thought that they could create a wonderful community, and that the challenges faced in Pressburg, the Kassab Sofer was willing to acknowledge that he was not up to the task. He's more of an old school person, that they need someone to deal with not just the young generation, but the more enlightened generation. Yet Israel Hildesheimer never comes to Eisenstadt, never leaves Eisenstadt, which is also in Hungary. It's south of Vienna at that time, but it was part of Hungary. He never leaves Hungary. Why not? He came to see that the religious situation was complicated in Pressburg. You had reformers, some of these maskilim were tilting towards reform. It was going to be a very complicated situation. And remember, it was his job to really relate to these people. In Eisenstadt, he didn't have to deal with reformers. He didn't have to deal with maskilim. I mean, he himself was somewhat liberal, but he would have had a difficult time in Pressburg. Also, his family, he says that his family was very attached to Eisenstadt. They did not want to leave. They would leave later for Berlin, but they did not want to leave. Actually, I shouldn't say his family was very attached. It could be that his family thought Eisenstadt was better than Pressburg. So his family put the pressure on him not to leave, and Eisenstadt was, and here I can use the word attached, Eisenstadt was very attached to the Israel Hildesheimer, and they begged him basically to stay. This relationship between the Kassab Sofer and Israel Hildesheimer, this close relationship, to give an example of how close it is, a number of people have written on this, and they give as the example the famous story that when the Kassab Sofer died, they waited 2 days to bury him in order to give Israel Hildesheimer a chance to get from Eisenstadt to Pressburg to give the eulogy. Usually, you know, we don't wait. They waited 2 nights. So they waited, if he died on a Sunday, they waited Sunday and then Monday night to bury him on Tuesday. All in order to let the news get, someone had to go tell Israel Hildesheimer, they didn't have a telegraph or anything, and then he had to come back. Of all the rabbis, Israel Hildesheimer was the one chosen to give the chief eulogy. Now remember, the Kassab Sofer had many students, and there were rabbis in Pressburg, and yet Israel Hildesheimer was chosen to give the chief eulogy, and this is often cited as a sign of how much the Kassab Sofer esteemed the Chasam Sofer, that the family, in choosing to pick the one big eulogy, they pick Israel Hildesheimer. And it's true. The Kassab Sofer and the family greatly esteemed Israel Hildesheimer. But there's a special reason why they waited. And this is for the to bury him and the Kassab Sofer. And this is not so well known. I mean, if you looked at the literature written right after the Kassab Sofer dies, and they write about how they waited for Israel Hildesheimer, the descriptions given are all because of the esteem, that it was the kavod. We're not supposed to let a dead lie without being buried, but for kavod hames, for the honor of the dead, we can, and therefore, you know, it was a great honor to have Israel Hildesheimer come. However, it was only in later years revealed that there was a special reason why they waited. And it's not so well known. Even today, it's not well known. After the Kassab Sofer died, the more enlightened section of the community opposed the appointment of his son, Rav Simcha Bunim, the Shevet Sofer. They wanted to bring in another rabbi, a more enlightened rabbi. They couldn't have the dual rabbi, so they wanted a more enlightened rabbi. That is why the body was not buried. The family and the traditionalist supporters of the Kassab Sofer wanted to give Israel Hildesheimer a chance to come to town because he was very friendly with this Aviezer Schick that I mentioned before. Schick was the one who, one of the leaders of the community who carried on the negotiations with Hildesheimer, and Schick respected Hildesheimer a lot. They wanted Hildesheimer to come to town Since Schick was one of the leaders of the opposition to Simcha Bunim, Hildesheimer would be able to speak to Schick and convince him to change his position. And that's exactly what happened. Hildesheimer comes to town, he speaks to him, and is able to convince the enlightened segments of the community to accept Simcha Bunim as the rabbi in the city. So why did he have to wait for Israel Hildesheimer? Because remember what I said before? How the Kassav Sofer was chosen at the funeral, that is, he was proclaimed. That's the tradition. They had to proclaim Rav Simcha Bunim Sofer at the funeral. That's the kavod to the new Rav. However, they couldn't because leading members of the community refused. And the family, the Kassav Sofer, doesn't run the community. You need to, in order to proclaim who the Rav of the community is going to be, obviously he's going to get a salary and everything, you need to have the agreement of the community. And there were important members of the community that did not agree with that. So in order to be able to proclaim Rav Simcha Bunim Sofer, and I will next class or the class after, I'll read you a bit of a portion of what they said at the funeral, how they proclaimed him. It'll remind you of what Chabad does today. In order to bring the community, I guess this is a heter in halacha, I don't know. I mean, you postpone a funeral in order to allow the community to come to an agreement. Who the next Rav is going to be? I guess you could say that's a kavod for the dead Rav, that his son will succeed him. But that's exactly what happened. Not only that, the Kassav Sofer in his hesped mentioned that the Sofer dynasty would continue in Pressburg. Schick went along with it, but Schick wasn't happy, and later he would actually be a leader in opening up the Neolog community in Pressburg. That is, the Neolog would be today right-wing conservative Judaism. He was one of the leaders in opening this breakaway group, this Neolog group in Pressburg, but when he saw that they didn't agree to appoint a Talmud Chacham as a Rav, he returned to the Orthodox community. There were Neolog Rabbanim who were Talmid Chachamim. When they couldn't appoint Rav Israel Hildesheimer, the Rav, they went with someone else. I could get to that in a second because I want to speak about something else first. In 1850, when the Kassav Sofer is Rav, a secondary school opens up, like a high school opens up for the Jews. Under government supervision. Actually, it's not for everyone, Jews and non-Jews, but Jews also. Which is unusual because until then, many of the schools did not allow Jews in. After the secondary school was opened, the government asked the religious leaders of the city, and that obviously includes Rav Israel Hildesheimer, Rav Avram Sofer, the Chassam Sofer, they asked the religious leaders to come into the school to speak to their followers, that is, their students, the Jewish students, and prepare them for their studies. They asked the religious leaders to come and give their blessing to this new high school. And the Kassav Sofer did so. I'm not saying he was happy about doing so. He was not a believer that Jewish students should go to a high school with non-Jewish students, but he was asked by the government to do it, and he did. He gathered the Jewish students together in the shul, and he spoke to them about how to behave with their non-Jewish colleagues. He spoke to them about how they have to observe Torah and mitzvos, even when they're at the school. This was something that in Germany was very common. I mean, everyone went to high school in Germany. There weren't any Jewish high schools, really, except for ones opens up in, talking about the mid-19th century, Hirsch opens a school, but other than that, Jews, every city Jews lived in, sometimes there are only a few Jewish families, they all went to Jewish school, went to non-Jewish schools. When we dealt years ago with David C. Hoffman, we dealt with his tshuva, his response about to go into school on Shabbos, how do you carry the books to school? But this was something new in Pressburg. Later, as I said, the Kassav Sofer had to go along with the students attending schools like this or private instruction for the four classes. Uh, So why did the Kassav Sofer, let me go back for a minute, agree in bringing in a modern rabbi? I said that he recognized that the younger generation, the more modern generation, couldn't be satisfied with his traditionalism. Well, why not? Why couldn't the Kassav Sofer had satisfied them? Well, first of all, the Kassav Sofer wasn't able to preach in pure German. He knew German. His father gave him into language instruction, but to actually preach to people with advanced secular educations, that he could not do. Furthermore, he recognized that there was a minority that wanted basically a neologue type synagogue. And in order to prevent serious deviations from halacha, he agreed that to appoint a rabbi who could speak German with a good secular education. When Hildesheimer did not accept it, they appointed a man by the name of Rabbi Feisch Fishman. He was the Rav of Klausenberg. We all know the great Hasidic dynasty, Klausenberg. When Klausenberg becomes part of Romania, it's called Cluj. Fishman is not appointed as a second rabbi, though. He is appointed as preacher, as Magid Meisharim. He has nothing to do with deciding halacha or the yeshiva. He's just the preacher. And he spoke a very good German. Who was his successor? And we're going to get back to Fleischmann. Who was Fleischmann's successor in Klausenberg? A man by the name of Rabbi Avraham Glasner. If anyone here is going to be listening is from the Washington, D.C. area, you'll know there's a Glasner, David Glasner up there. This is direct descendant. Avraham Glasner was married to the Chassam Sofer's granddaughter. He was the rabbi of Klausenberg. His son is a figure that we will deal with, known as the Dor Revi'i, another Glasner. We're going to have classes on him because of the fourth generation from the Chassam Sofer. So the Chassam Sofer's grandson-in-law becomes the rabbi of Klausenberg. Glasner tells us that the Chassam Sofer's daughter, his mother-in-law, encouraged him to also study secular subjects. Let me read to you what he said. This comes from Jacob Katz's book, A House Divided, subtitle, Orthodoxy and Schism in 19th Century Central European Jewry. This is Rav Avraham Glasner telling us what the Chassam Sofer's daughter said to him. About half a year ago, my pious mother-in-law, long may she live, with my father-in-law, long may he live, in agreement, came to me and said that they saw that I do not occupy myself with secular studies, and they irked me by saying, why do you not occupy yourself with other things as well? At least go and study Hungarian and the language of culture, German, with taste and discernment, for this is the sum of man, and you cannot achieve anything without these two languages. And then later, he says, they told him that even if he wishes to engage in the rabbinate that is not in business, quote, you yourself know what people demand of their shepherd. They do not wish him to be a Torah scholar, but a spokesman of his nation, and for him to speak pleasantly in the non-Jewish language. So here we have Rav Avraham Glasner reporting that his mother-in-law told him that it was vital for him to learn German so that he could speak to his community. Okay, so how did the Kassav Sofer agree, though, to bring in a German preacher? If you recall, the Chassam Sofer, his father, before he died, had an ethical will. And in this ethical will, he told his children some things. He told them, don't read the books of Mendelssohn. He said some other things. And one of the things he said was that don't bring in a German preacher. Only have Yiddish preachers. And here the Kassav Sofer goes and violates his father, whom he idolized, violates his father's ethical will that said that it's forbidden to have German preacher. This violation of the Chassam Sofer's ethical will led to a huge dispute, because the Chassam Sofer had all sorts of students. He had middle-of-the-road students, he had liberal students, and he had extremist students. One of the extremist students was a man by the name of Hillel Lichtenstein. And Lichtenstein had a son-in-law who was also a big extremist, Rabbi Kiva Joseph Schlesinger. We're going to have classes on him. Liechtenstein attacks the Kassav Sofer. He previously had attacked Israel Hildesheimer, calling him a heretic. Terrible things he says about him. He attacks the Kassav Sofer, doesn't say such extreme things, doesn't call him a heretic, but he writes about how terrible this is. He uses the word Echa, how bad Pressburg, which once was a great city, now they're going to have a German preacher. He attacks Reb Fishman, who everyone recognized was a tzaddik. So you have this terrible dispute breaking out between Reb Hillel Liechtenstein, who believes that he is following the will of the Chassam Sofer, and that the son of the Chassam Sofer is rejecting his father. Well, the Kassav Sofer had two approaches. First of all, he believed that when his father opposed German preachers, he opposed it because of the heretical ideas they would espouse. In the Chassam Sofer's day, you didn't really have rabbis, pious rabbis who knew German, living in Hungary. All you had were maskilim and reformers and heretics. However, if you could have pious rabbis who could speak proper German, then the Kassav Sofer didn't think his father would have a problem with it. And Rabbi Fishman from Klausenberg fell into that category. In fact, Rabbi Fishman, to show how admired he was, if you go today in Pressburg, in the new cemetery, to the Kassav Sofer's grave, right next to the Kassav Sofer is Rabbi Fleisch Fishman. And many, many people come to the Kassav Sofer's grave, and they do not know. I even had a learned tour guide take me there. He was my driver and tour guide, and he did not know who Rabbi Fleisch Fishman was. And this is right next to the Kassav Sofer's grave. It's not an accident he's buried there. He's buried right there to show that these two were joined in their quest to keep Pressburg a religious city. Incidentally, not very far from the Kassav Sofer is the other big extremist, Rabbi Chaim Sofer, who I mentioned already. He had died in Budapest, but he didn't want to be buried in Budapest because there were Mechalei Shabbos in the cemetery, so he was brought back to his city. That's where he grew up, in Pressburg, and he's buried there. So the first thing is the Kassav Sofer said, I don't know if this is disingenuous or not, Hillel Liechtenstein thought it was disingenuous. The Kassav Sofer, though, says that thinks that his father is not opposed to German per se, if they're pious preachers. Second of all, today you had a new situation. When the Chassam Sofer was speaking about this, everyone knew, spoke Yiddish. But today, the younger generation speaks German. How can you preach only in Yiddish when the younger generation doesn't know Yiddish? In 1865, however, the extremists, led by Rahil Liechtenstein, gathered in a place called Michalowicz in Hungary and issued a psak halacha. They describe this as a psak halacha to bind everyone. What that means is to bind all of Hungary. Although only 16 rabbis of cities came, 18 rabbis in total, they declared that they were the highest authority in Hungary. And later they get other rabbis to sign the documents, so that in total they have 83 signatures, and among the signatures is Rabbi Shlomo Gansfried, the author of the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. Now I want to read you the decrees that they passed, 9 decrees, which they claim that these bind everyone. I mean, if you read the language of it, it binds everyone throughout the world. But, well, you have to take that with a grain of salt. They weren't talking about what goes on in the Sephardic world or what goes on in America, but they're talking about in their lands in Hungary. And if you don't follow this, your synagogue is not regarded as an Orthodox institution and you cannot step foot in this shul. These are the decrees. And why did they make these decrees? They made these decrees because of, first of all, because of the growing power of the neologues. They made these decrees because of people like the Kassav Sofer and Israel Hildesheimer, which were compromising with modernity. Decree number 1. It is forbidden to listen to a synagogue sermon given in a foreign language. The true believer must leave such a synagogue. The rabbi should speak in Yiddish, which is used by the pious of the country. So vernacular sermons were forbidden. If you look in the Leiv Ivri of Akiva Yosef Schlesinger, he has a whole discussion of all these. It's said that when it's recorded that the week the Shabbos after this decree was proclaimed, and it was time for a Feish fisherman to preach in German in the great synagogue in Pressburg, he doesn't get up. He's worried. He doesn't know what to do. And the Ksav Sofer tells him, no, you go preach, because the Ksav Sofer did not accept these decrees. Incidentally, the Maharam Shik, who other than Ksav Sofer is maybe the greatest of the students of the Chasam Sofer, he opposed the decrees. But he said, since the majority of Hungarian rabbis accept them, I too have to accept them. Whereas the Ksav Sofer rejected them, and Israel Hildesheimer wrote a whole document opposing them. Israel Hildesheimer's point was that it doesn't matter if you bring 83 rabbis or you bring 830 rabbis. We don't have a Sanhedrin anymore. And therefore, I, in Eisenstadt, and the Mara D'Asra, I'm not bound by you. We no longer have a Sanhedrin, and you cannot grab together a majority of rabbis and say, therefore, I am bound to listen to you. And I think that's it's an important point. The fact that you can get maybe a Agudas Yisrael, maybe can get a whole group of rabbis to get together and say, this is halacha, doesn't matter. They're not your rabbis, and they can't bind you. There's no Sanhedrin there. There's no Beis Din HaGadol. And majority does not determine how we have to live. If you have your Rav, and he says, and this applies in halacha, and obviously in other things. These Michalovitz, it's really the first example of organized Das Torah. They don't give any justification here. No halachic justification. This is why it's a mistake to see Das Torah as a Lithuanian thing. You see it right here. These are decrees without any justification, without any chance of appeal or anything. It's because the Gedolim said it. Everyone must listen. Decree number two. It's forbidden to pray in a synagogue in which the Bima is not in the center. That's an old issue. The reformers moved the Bima from the center to the front to be more like a church. Although there's no halacha, really. The Rambam doesn't... look at the Chesed Mishnah of the Rambam. He said the only reason to have the Bima in the middle is because more people can hear. But this became one of these boundary markers. Although in the Sephardic countries, and in Italy, for example, the Bima's not in the middle. But this was a big issue. Ramosha Feinstein, it's interesting, Ramosha Feinstein has a tshuva about this, and Ramosha Feinstein doesn't know about the whole controversy. You know, someone asked him about going into a shul without a bima in the middle, and he's like, well, I mean, our practice is to have it in the middle, but it's really not halacha or anything. And if I remember correctly, he says something like, and what you say that there's a decree against in Hungary, that must have been haracha, an emergency measure, but it's clearly not. But it wasn't an emergency measure. This decree was to be binding. Not just because of an emergency measure, it's a permanent decree. Three, it's forbidden to build a tower on the synagogue, like the churches have. Four, the cantor and the prayer leader are forbidden to wear a vestment for the services. Remember, any synagogue in which they do this in is a pusul synagogue. You must leave this synagogue. Five, the women's gallery must be closed up with a dense lattice. In Hungary, and Israel Hildesheimer, by the way, agreed with this. In his whole long article attacking the Michalowicz decrees, he says, this one I agree with. The practice in Hungary was the women were upstairs, and you couldn't see them, though, because it's not just there's a balcony, like you had in many places, but you have lattice work. That is, you had basically in all sorts of decorations in front of the women that even when they're standing, you can't see through. They can see because they can put their eyes to it, but you cannot make out the faces. I guess unless they're very tall. This was the viewpoint in Hungary. That this is an old dispute. Many of us probably know the dispute, the Ramosha Feinstein and the Satmar Rav, over what the role of the Mechitza is. And Ramosha Feinstein says, it goes down to how to read a Rambam, Ramosha Feinstein's position, and this was the Lithuanian position, is that the purpose of the Mechitza is to prevent mingling, and therefore it doesn't matter if I can see the women. It has to be tall enough to prevent me from going back and forth, or I guess my body leaning over, that sort of thing. The Satmar Rav, see the Rambam, the Lashon of the Rambam, the Mishnah Torah is the mingling Lashon, but in the Parasha Mishnah, he uses the language of to see. The Satmar Rav said that you have to have Mechitza so that you can't see the women, and people who don't know that much about Hungary portray this dispute when they write about it as between the extremist Satmar Rav, and no question about it, he was extreme, And they, but they say this is between the extremes, Satmar Rav and Ramosha Feinstein, who's representing mainstream orthodoxy. It's not true at all. The Satmar Rav's position is mainstream Hungarian position, even shared by the likes of the liberal heretic, in quotes, Israel Hildesheimer. If you go today in Budapest to the main shul, which is a non-Hasidic shul, which is an Orthodox shul of people who had who spoke Hungarian and were modern types, the women's section, you cannot see the women. This was the practice in Hungary. However, they were nervous that the neologues had begun to take down the lattice. The neologues still insisted. If you go to the Gohani Synagogue, for example, in Budapest, you'll see that there's a gallery where the women would sit. But the gallery is like the gallery, let's say, in lots of other synagogues. Always Siddiq in New York. Typical galleries in America, there aren't that many left, where the women are above, but you could see the women. In Budapest, you can't see the women. So, that's decree number five. Decree number six. It's forbidden to listen to the singing of a choir, to pray together with it, and to say Amen after such prayers. That is no choirs. It's a Christian thing. Seven. It's forbidden to enter a choir synagogue. Not just to, you might say, well, you can't go Shabbos morning because you have the choir. You can't ever go into that synagogue because such synagogues are houses of heresy and are worse than the temples of the pagans. So you can't go into Washington Heights or Spanish and Portuguese because they have choirs. From the standpoint of Shimshon and Paul Hirsch, what's wrong with a choir? It doesn't violate halacha. It's fine. So the non-Orthodox do it. So the non-Jews have choirs. But if it makes the davening more appealing, we can do that too. You had choirs in Eastern Europe. You had choirs in Lithuania and Poland. In Orthodox shuls, you had choirs. But no choirs for Hungary. Harvey says that the shul he grew up in Southfield added lattice to cover the top of the machitza about a decade ago with the yeshiva shlitvish rav. Huh. What you have, Harvey, in almost every modern Orthodox shul in the country, there has been movements to raise the machitza. I don't know what percentage of them have raised it. My shul in West Orange, New Jersey, raised it about 10 years ago. I was in Lawrence, Long Island, two Shabbos ago, and they have a high machitza. So I asked the Rav, you know, Lawrence, when was the machitza raised? And he told me, you see this all over America now, that machitzas have been raised. Now, my shul, they didn't really raise it with lattice work. What they did is, the mechitza was somewhat low, so instead they put glass for the next, 2 feet. So now the mechitza is 2 feet higher. However, the upper 2 feet is glass work. So you're saying in Southfield they added the lattice so you couldn't see. I've seen that also. In fact, I assume I've been to the shul in Southfield because I was in two different shuls in Southfield. But that is common with the raising of the machitzas. But it's not a Hungarian thing for the most part. In Lithuania, the idea was that they never had understood it. I should say never. There were some who did. But the standard viewpoint was that not that you couldn't see, but that you couldn't mingle. Eight. Weddings can be celebrated only under the open sky. Not only can't you have a wedding in a shul, you can't have a wedding indoors, but if you want to have a wedding indoors, then you can open up the roof, things like that. But weddings in a shul were absolutely forbidden. And that's really what it's directed against. They didn't have catering halls in Hungary. It's not like today where you can have a wedding in a catering hall. The only place to have a wedding is outdoors, or you have it inside the shul. That's where the neologues started having it. And what's wrong with having a wedding in a shul? It's beautiful. It's mukkah, a holy place. And we know that in medieval times. I think it's the Ma'aril mentions having a wedding in a shul. However, once the non-Jews once became important, when the Jews recognized how the non-Jews have weddings in churches, when this became in part of the Jewish consciousness, then they said, well, we can't do that. Catholic weddings, for example, have to be in churches. They can't be anywhere else. So, here, and yet, look at art in America today. most weddings, or many weddings, do take place in shuls. And again, for the Lithuanians, this is something that they don't take so seriously. Ramosha has a tshuva about this also. I know it's brought down. I saw that Rabbi Soloveitchik didn't like to go to weddings and shuls. But if he was asked, he would go. But really, for the Lithuanians, this wasn't an issue at all. In fact, maybe it was the tshuva dealing with weddings in the shul, not the, that Ramosha answers the question that that it was Harad Shah. I can't remember now if it was the weddings in shul or if it was the bima in the middle. But basically, for the Lithuanians, having weddings in shuls were not a big deal. For Hungarians, it was absolutely forbidden. And today, if you go to Budapest, you will see right outside the shul, there is a permanent chuppah in the courtyard. Because God forbid, it's absolutely usur to have a wedding in a shul. Now today, I don't know. Does anyone know of any rabbis today who will refuse to do a wedding in a shul, perform a wedding in a shul, or refuse to not just perform a wedding in a shul? For a real Hungarian, you can't even go to a wedding that takes place in a shul. But I don't know. I haven't heard much dispute about this. The Hasidim to this day won't do it in a shul, but other than the Hasidim, I mean, did anyone ever come across a situation? I haven't really. 9. If everything I said wasn't enough, listen to the 9th decree. It is forbidden to change any Jewish custom or rule inherited from our ancestors. In other words, you didn't need to have all the other 8. All you needed was to have that one. Because that says we can't change any practice. But what they wanted to do is they wanted to specify that which they felt were important. And then, in case they forgot anything, you cannot change anything. And anyone who disobeys this, they're not regarded to be Orthodox. They're out of the fold. So there was another violation of the Michalowicz decrees, not just the German preacher. The great shul in Pressburg was actually built with a tower on top of it, if you can believe that. I can't take a picture of it because the shul doesn't exist anymore. It was destroyed. It was destroyed during the communists. Otherwise, it would be great because we don't really have it. We have descriptions of it. We don't know exactly what it looked like. Rabbi Kiva Yosef Schlesinger attacks the Pressburg community for allowing this. And he says that this tower in the shul was done by the community leader called Ketav Yosher Divrei Emet, which was written by people in Pressburg against the Kiva Yosef Schlesinger to refute everything he says, and they say that this is a lie. And the tower was actually built by mistake by the architect. That is, he started building it, and the people didn't realize what it was until it was too late. And it wasn't really a tower because it was circular. But still, the Kasav Sofer said that it should be taken down when you can. The problem is it wasn't easy to fix. It would cost a lot of money. They had already built most of it. I don't know if it was ever taken down or if it remained there to the end. So the Pressburg violated 2 aspects, or he sort of violated. They violated, they had German sermons, and they also had a tower on the shul, which means, according to the extremists in Hungary, it is forbidden to enter the great shul in Pressburg. Can you believe it? Forbidden to enter the shul of the Kasav Sofer. But we have examples of this sort of extremism. In Frankfurt, for example, for the Hirschians, it was forbidden to step foot into the great shul of Frankfurt. That is the shul which Rav Marcus Horovitz, the Mate Levi, was the rav of. Which Rav Menachem Mendel Kirschbaum, the Menachem Meshiv, was the dayan. Which Rav Yaakov Hoffman later, who comes to America, he was the rabbi of OZ, was the rav. This shul was considered forbidden territory because the shul was not a member of the separatist kahila. It was the general community. So we have examples of this. In fact, with reference to the German preaching, if you look in the Igrot Sofrim, which is the letters, the collected letters of the Chasam Sofer and the Kasav Sofer and the Shevet Sofer, in the first letter in the Kasav Sofer section is from Daniel Prosnitz, the Av Beis Din of Pressburg, to the Kassav Sofer, asking him to write to a certain community to tell them that if they need a rabbi who also has secular learning and knows German, that the Kassav Sofer will help them out. Now, the Kassav Sofer's position was supported by his brother. He had a brother who was the Rav in Krakow, or Shimon Sofer. And he also has a letter in which he writes there was a community that was persecuting a rabbi because the Hasidim were persecuting him because the rabbi preached in, he was going to preach when he was hired, in German. And Rav Shimon writes to defend this community, to defend the rabbi. Rav Shimon, by the way, was a member of the Austrian Parliament. How was he a member of the Austrian Parliament? Because after the third and final partition of Poland in 1795, Krakow becomes part of the Habsburg Empire. The Austrians ruled Krakow until World War I, that is, until the end of World War I, 1918. Okay, I see it's already 10, so we are going to stop. We have more to do, though, with the Kassav Sofer. We'll stop here if anyone has questions. This, as I said, is the last class of the semester. We probably have one more class of the Kassav Sofer. Then we're going to move into Rabbi Moshe Kunitz, who was a rabbi at this very same time, the same time as the Chasam Sofer. I guess you could say a liberal Orthodox rabbi. That'll just be also maybe one or two classes, but I think you'll find him interesting. And then we're going to move into a major figure, Rav Meir Simcha of Dvinsk. So there's a lot of good stuff coming. So Shlomo says, Benigros Moshe or Achayim 242, it's about the Bima in the middle. He says it's Harasha because of Reform. Yeah, that's what I was remembering. He also has a tshuva about going into about a wedding in Shul. I'm pretty sure about it, but I don't know if he says it's Harasha. And Rav Moshe Feinstein is wrong in this. At least he's wrong. I mean, he's right. If you're a historian, he's definitely right. It's only because of Reform they were led to this. But for the rabbis who signed this decree, they don't think it's Harasha. They think it's Minhag Yisrael. And therefore, this has to be permanent. It doesn't matter if there's any reform around. This is our minhag, and it's only because the reformers are trying to change it that we have to stress it and make it into a cheirem. But it's when Rav Moshe Feinstein says it's harasha, what that means if you're in another place like America, it's not a big deal. And they said, no, absolutely not. It's a big deal everywhere you go. And I'm not going to say that they were saying you can't step foot into a shul in New York, although if you read the language, that is what they're saying. But, I mean, that wasn't what was in their minds, I don't think. But they were saying that it doesn't matter what's in your community in Hungary, or not just in Hungary, in Germany, places like that, you can't change the practice. You can't move the bima. And Shlomo says that he has another tshuva in which he says there's no problem. And for a Lithuanian, these were not big issues because they didn't deal with the reformers. But as I said just now, from the Hungarian standpoint, this isn't just about reform. The reform is trying to change the practices, which is why they have to have these decrees and make these declarations. But the practice in and of itself is proper. Rezriel Hildesheimer, though, he rejects the idea about the beam in the middle. He agrees that you have to have a beam in the middle. But he says, but that doesn't possible the shul. And in terms of having a choir and the cantor with robes, he says, that's nonsense. There's nothing wrong with this. So he rejects it. Bill says, wasn't there an important court case regarding the shul's machitz in New Orleans? Sure, there was an important court case. It's called, a whole book was published on it by Baruch Litvin with all the documentation called The Sanctity of the Synagogue. Mount Clemens. No, it wasn't New Orleans, it was Mount Clemens. I forget where Mount Clemens is. I think it's Mount Clemens. What happened was, it's a very interesting constitutional case. This was an Orthodox shul, but the membership had moved in the direction of non-Orthodox, of conservatives. So what do you do? We have a case like this. The shul was founded. People give money to build an Orthodox shul. But then the membership, obviously if the majority of the membership decides they don't want a mechitza, they can vote and change it. However, this Litvin brought a court case, and he got Israel, Rabbi Lazar Silver testified. You have letters there from Rabbi Soloveitchik and all the other great rabbis. He claimed that since the shul was established as an Orthodox shul, people gave money so that it would be an Orthodox synagogue. you can't change it now. Even it's essential to its identity. And if I'm not mistaken, he won the court case. That the court ruled that because people established it a certain way, money was given, etc. The members would have to make a new synagogue. This is where the whole Young Israel business comes in. Where they get this idea that the Young Israel movement, that Shul's, when they were formed, they put it in their charter that if they violate Young Israelite movement rules, that the Shul can be taken, the property. Because you had people in the early part of the 20th century, when the movement was to conservative Judaism, they're giving all this money to build, let's say your parents gave all this money to build up the shul. They want to make sure that in perpetuity, forever, this shul is Orthodox. And how can you guarantee this? Because if the majority decides to change, this is before the case, and I don't know if that case would have been upheld in other districts. What happens if the membership decides to get rid of the mechitzas, as happened in many shuls? How do you guarantee that can never happen? Well, you guarantee it by making sure that at the end of the day, the Young Israel movement, if the shul decides to violate the charter by violate the Young Israel charter by getting rid of the mechitzah, the Young Israel can take the shul. The problem is, of course, that the Young Israel movement changed its charter. About 15 years ago or so, they put in new rules that a woman could be president and a convert could be president, all that. And that's called changing the game after it already started. So they want to change the rules and now say that all these other Young Israels are bound. For those who are members of Young Israel, you know that there's been a big movement to try to abolish this thing because you have shuls. It's not fair. You know, they take their property and everything. And last week, the president and the vice president and the executive director were all forced out of Young Israel. It's not clear who forced them out because the Young Israel movement, as we speak, is in violation of all sorts of laws. They have to, according to law, have elections, I'm sorry, every 2 years. And they haven't had elections in many years. And they don't care. They're just in violation of the law. And it's going to take someone to sue them. So I'm not sure who is the power that decided, I mean, they're very worried that they're going to be sued. So they forced out the president, the vice president, and his learner. He announced that he's taking a 6-month sabbatical. I find it unlikely if he ever comes back, because he's the real problem in this whole situation. But, so they cleaned house, and in their press release, it says that in accordance with their constitution, now the vice president or whoever was next in command takes over. Of course, the whole thing is crazy because they don't follow their own constitution, which requires that you have to have elections. But, it's because the Young Israel movement wanted to take properties of different shuls that violated their rules that created all this controversy. So they apparently, the people who are behind the scenes of the Young Israel, some of you listening might have more information on this. They obviously think that by pushing out the current leadership, which is responsible for the whole debacle, that they can keep everything in place. In any event, the whole movement doesn't need to exist. It's a waste of money. It's a waste of office space. You have the OU. What do you need Young Israel for? You needed it at a time, but today you don't. Let's see. Questions or comments? The Harasha was Wichita, Kansas. That's different, though. We're talking about I think it's Mount Clemens. Bill says, the best line on the dynasty is Professor Katz calling the fourth generation a toe so far. I guess all good things must end. I don't remember if he calls it that in the book or not, or if it's, does he say it in the book? I forget, but it's famous. I will read you when I get to the next class when we finish. If you remember, Bill, you let us know if it's in the book. He writes about how Rabbi Kiva Sofer was not really, it's in his autobiography. Rabbi Kiva Sofer, he writes about in his autobiography, was not really suited to be the Rav. And that after the Holocaust, when he was in Jerusalem and Yaakov Katz again had a relationship with him there, he saw he was much happier and much more at peace. He actually would daven at Merkaz HaRav, because he lived right near there. But yes, so they went from the Chasam Sofer, the Kasav Sofer, to the Shevet Sofer, and then there was the Da'at Sofer. But if you're an opponent of him or you weren't impressed, you called it the Taut Sofer. There was also the Chatan, the Chasam Sofer. There's a big yeshiva in New York, the Chasam Sofer, from the son-in-law or one of the sons-in-law. You have another number of other sofers related who use that in their title. Yes, Mount Clemens, Michigan. That's the Litvin case. But that is about getting rid of the mechitza entirely. It's not about the height of the mechitza or anything like that. If you assume that the reason for the mechitza is to stop mingling, well, then you could really have a very low mechitza. I mean, I don't know what mingling really means, but Rabbi Soloveitchik, I forget what he said, 40-some inches he would agree with if the shul, as a basic minimum, if he couldn't go any higher, he preferred higher, but I forget the exact number. I think it was 40-some inches, maybe 41 or even 40 inches, and you had Orthodox shuls like that. If you can go higher, or Moshe Feinstein had a higher level. I don't know how you really pick exact numbers on anything like this. I mean, I don't know who determines that. If you look in the Igros Moshe, he has a tshuva there to Rabbi Tibor Stern. That Tibor Stern, who later becomes Hebrew National Mashgiach, a big Talmud Chacham in Miami Beach, he wanted to say that it's enough just to have a tiny little, like a 10-inch type of mechitza, that should be enough. And Rav Moshe Feinstein is very upset with that. But if the whole point is to stop mingling, then let's say you have men and women in a shul and you had maybe a 10-foot separation between men and women. Does that satisfy the need to have a separation? This whole business of mechitza is very modern. You never had mechitzas really in Europe. What you had is you had women either above in the balconies or you had women like behind walls where they would have little openings where the women can look out. But the situation we have today where men and women sit right next to one another and just a little wall separating them, this is a very American thing. I don't believe that there was ever a shul in Europe. I haven't been to every shul, but I think that this is a completely American innovation where men and women sit right next to one another with a little wall. You could have in some shuls, the Jewish Center and other places, you could literally lean over and there's a woman right there. Bill said they davened in a shul in New Orleans and also had a court case over the mechitza. Yeah, try to track it down if you can, if that's the similar case. Doesn't ring a bell. The one I'm talking about was the famous one. I'm vaguely remembering something about New Orleans, but I can't place it. So hopefully you'll find it and you'll send it to me, and I'll report on it next semester. By the way, before we go, we're talking so much about mechitza. There is nothing about mechitza in the Shulchan Aruch at all. So how do you know you need a mechitza even? I tell you, and I've said this before and I say it again, if there was not a conservative movement which made removal of the mechitza one of their major focuses, foci, there is no question that liberal Orthodox, I don't know if it's modern Orthodox, but more liberal Orthodox, they're definitely within a segment of the modern Orthodox movement that would have pushed for getting rid of the mechitza. If you can have women in so-called Orthodox shuls leading davening today, Kabbalah Shabbos and things like that, you can certainly get rid of the mechitza. So why won't they get rid of the mechitza? They'll put the Sefer Torah in the middle, they'll have the woman read the Torah from one side, the man on the other, because everyone wants to say that they're Orthodox, they're not conservative. Conservative is a bad word. So therefore, you can never get rid of the mechitza, even if you can have more justification for getting rid of the mechitza than you can have for a woman leading davening, but that became central to what the conservative movement was. But it's the truth. There's no reference to a mechitza in the Shulchan Aruch. Okay, everyone, good night. Have a good Hanukkah, Freilich Hanukkah. I'm holding on. Eva is typing something, and after that, I'm going to say good night to everyone. Okay, thank you very much. Thank you again, all of you. As always, I learned a great deal from your comments or questions, and I hope to pick up not too many weeks from now. Good night.